This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about working from home, something we've both had a lot of personal experience of at the moment. And so understand really from first-hand perspective how much this can impact our mental health. And it's not just us. Nuffield Health reported that in a recent survey, 80% of Brits feel that working from home has had a negative impact on their mental health. And a quarter of those working from home say they are finding it difficult to cope with the mental challenges of loneliness and isolation from colleagues. So massive statistics, and you know, the 80% one somehow shocked me, even though it is 100% of my friends working from home that are finding the same thing.
I know, it's a huge statistic, and you know, we've got to remember that so many people have worked from home for such a long time. And actually, I'd be interested, I've asked myself this because I'm one of them. It's always been okay because I've always had the flexibility. There have been offices to go in. There has been, you know, meetings or motorways to drive on to different meetings or trains to catch. So with that, you enjoy then that respite on a Wednesday when you know you've not got any meetings face to face. You can be at home, or Friday afternoon, you can work from home. But the fact that we're like locked in and working from home had a negative impact, because we talk a lot about burnout and people being overworked and never switching off. And a lot of the tips that people talk about is that kind of make sure you switch off and your laptop should put it away. And if you're lucky enough to have a separate room, which not many people have, then be in a separate room for your work. But there's the other side of it as well. I think when you work from home, if you're somebody that's not, you know, full on it all the time and you get distracted and you're less productive, that can also have a really negative impact. We don't speak about that as much, you know, because you feel bad, you feel guilty. You know, you're like, oh shit, I should have done that. Why haven't I done that? I can't be bothered to get up this morning. I want to stay in my dressing gown all day. And then that's when I think the unraveling can occur too.
Right. And I'm not going to name names, but I've got two friends in particular that I've had to highlight to each of them recently the kind of irony that they're really worried about their productivity whilst working from home. And yet they were not so worried when they were working in offices. They seemed a lot less interested, but something about being at home and perhaps also the turbulence of the job market at the moment, everyone is suddenly taking it in a very personal way, you know, of how are my colleagues going to think about me and, you know, what will my boss think? But this is the kind of, I guess, vulnerability is what I would put it down to of this. And, you know, another stat we had was from the Office of National Statistics, who looked at the percentage of where people worked in their homes. So for 23% of people, the kitchen, 20% their living room, and 22% their bedrooms. So for the second highest one to be bedrooms, you know, there is something intimate and vulnerable about that. People whose house you may have never been invited to, you know, a colleague you don't know, you may have never even met them pre-pandemic if they're new, and now they're seeing inside your bedroom.
I know.
And we're realizing a lot less of us enjoy working from home than maybe we thought.
I think that's absolutely right. It's a great point. And as you brought up with childcare, it's always been a thing. Being not at home, like my children have been in after school club, like, I don't know, since they were probably both 6 months old at nursery full time, like, sick till 6 o'clock in the evening. And then when they started school, you know, there had to be an after school club there at school, you know, and they love it for one. So before we get any complaints about how can you leave your children in after school club all day, every day. But the thing is, working from home has meant, I mean, now, unfortunately, our after school club has closed until March, which has really been hard for so many parents. Again, working from home, it was always a real toss up as well, Bob, because you feel like if you're at home, then your kids, how are you justifying paying for after school club and not picking them up from school when you're at home? But work is home. And I think I felt more comfortable doing it since the pandemic because everybody's working from home. So it's almost like, well, it's still work. Honestly, I am working even though I'm at home. Whereas, say, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I go and pick my kids up at 6, like in my trackies. And I think the teachers must think, like, what, are you just at home all day? Like, drop them off in the morning, pick them up at 6, like, not really this was before everything was on Zoom, you know, I've had an office day and writing reports or whatever. And you'd think, oh, I am actually working, but it feels a little bit more justified now to have them in a place of care, like an after school club, even though I'm at home.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And it's this issue where so often we're better at setting priorities for the sake of other people than we are for ourselves. And I remember one of the most profound experiences I've had within a running a business in that context is I went on a marketing course, and it was, you know, quite a specialized qualification, I guess. And yeah. So there were 7 people on the course, including me. The other 6 had all had their workplace pay for it. So they'd had the time booked off and the course had been paid for them. I was the only one that wasn't in that situation and was already self-employed. And right. I remember when they realized that, because there was a lot of group discussion, and someone asked me, how do you motivate yourself? You know, if you're working for yourself, if you don't have a boss, how do you motivate yourself? And the whole table kind of turned to me, because they obviously were all confused about the same thing. And yeah. I remember just realizing how different my perspective was to a lot of people, because I was there thinking, well, how do you all motivate yourself? Because you're working towards, these are, you know, corporate jobs. You're working towards someone else's financial dreams and ambitions.
Yeah.
And you're getting up every day for that. But I think really when you drill down to it, what they're actually getting up for is because of the consequences. You know, mm-hmm. the colleagues that are going to be disappointed in them. You know, what's their boss going to say? Is it going to affect their pay rise next year? You know, it's all these kind of social accountabilities.
Yeah.
You know, they're not there for the company, they're there for their pay and for the colleagues. And so, you know, reading that bit about such an impact of loneliness and isolation from colleagues, we rarely talk about in the pandemic. We've talked about it with friends and family, but it's sort of those two sides. On one hand, you miss them. It's the social side. It's the people you interact with. It's the, you know, the small talk we're not getting. Are you getting the office gossip? You know, that's, people need that kind of like lower level interaction. It can all be business and changing the world. But also that element of, well, your colleagues are the people that keep you accountable.
I totally agree. You know, in the episode you talk about with our guests about, you know, being, going right down to the vending machine or down to the canteen to get a cup of tea, and those moments that you are at work, but you're not sat in front of the screen doing something, and you're connecting with the work environment, even if, you know, it's seeing Sue behind the counter or whatever, you know, and just saying hi and good morning. And I tell you what, through a lot of my colleagues and some friends that work in this field, there've been some great organisations, and the ones that are coming out on top are those that have ensured that they've put that time in for that connection. You know, you book in the diaries that the session finishes at 4:30, but you've made sure that you've scheduled the work till 4, so people haven't really got anything else to do because they think it's finishing at 4:30. But that half an hour is in place for, I don't know, a quiz or breakout rooms where you have a chat and a coffee, or go in any room you want. This one's going to be on this and this one's going to be talking about that. You know, pick a room. Where do you want to go? Who do you want to talk to?
Yeah. And I think it's fair to say we've both found it really challenging. I think perhaps in the first lockdown, we were better prepared as people that work from home as part of our work anyway. Yeah. So initially we could do it. But now that it's been so many months, you know, because for us, working from home isn't just sat in the same room with someone we live with in another room, and you're sort of like siloed in the house. Instead, it's true, though, it can feel like that. But we've got, you know, normally a lot of travel as part of our work, and we you know, maybe we have to go to London for something, but then we meet up with some friends afterwards. You know, there's all these other elements built in, whereas now it's sort of sat at a desk. And so, you know, that recently I joined a hot desking service because I just, in the beginning of this second lockdown, was really struggling to motivate myself. And the work is piling up, the emails are still coming through. There can be that expectation that you should be even more productive because you're at home, you've got all this free time, you know?
Yeah.
But you don't necessarily.
No.
All your other commitments are still there. Work, at least for us, is actually no less busy, perhaps even more busy in some ways. And so I was really struggling to keep on top of that. And so I joined a co-working space. I'd done them before, like Regus and WeWork, if people want recommendations. And I found it really helpful. Yeah. I have somewhere to go. I get to go to work, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, and you're around people, and I don't know anyone, you know, by name other than the reception team, but it's something about being in a public space. And again, a bit of that social accountability. Mm. You know, I can't get distracted and be watching movie trailers or go down a YouTube rabbit hole where I watch something for work and then it suggests a funny video and I'm gone. You feel you can't do that because you're like, well, if I'm just watching stupid videos, people are going to be like, he's not working. The reality is nobody probably cares, but it's enough to keep you on task.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry. And I was saying as well, and also you're paying for that space. So you feel more accountable to yourself and your finances to be like, I'm not paying for a space to just do something that I could sit in my bedroom and do, like get your head down and get on with your work. And there are distractions at home. No matter how much you just sit in a room, you know, there are so many distractions and so many things, you could be doing. Like I'm talking to you now. And I'm looking around my kitchen table thinking, why have I got like Harry Potter Lego half done and like a pair of earmuffs? And like, even knowing that, oh, so my daughter's forgot her earmuffs today because they're on the table. Even just that is a distraction when you're working, because everything around you just sparks these different thoughts. So I'm obviously in the conversation with you now and I'm in the moment, but I am, if I'm honest, thinking I've got, you know, this Harry Potter bus. In fact, I'll show it you.
Oh, nice.
I know. It's a little bit tricky, but hold on a second, because Anthony's just come in the room and I don't think he thinks we're recording, Bob.
I love that we're illustrating it, working from home, and then your partner walks in. We have to pause.
True.
We're living it.
Yeah, that's so true. This is real talk.
All these distractions, and they're personal, they're emotive distractions. It's your kids, something or other. It's not, you know, a stapler that's been left on your desk. Like it's higher stakes stuff.
And, yeah, it is.
you know, so it is more distracting. And this is coming from someone that has been on a work call at a workplace and been distracted by a stapler. So it's all sorts. And there's a stapler actually just sat there. So I wonder if that's what's put that in my head. Because now I'm distracted by one I've just seen. Anyway, God, we're really demonstrating what we're saying, aren't we?
We are. And I drove past the college by me not yesterday, but they were in there studying, and it's quite a new modern building. It looked really cool. It's a huge window so you can see straight into the classroom. And I just like nearly wanted to like pull over my car and like just gaze in the window and be like, I would just love to be in that situation right now. Like I really am. Which is why I've got to sort it out, because I'm really just love being connected with people. So I like delivering the work that I do because it's people all the time. And I found it really hard delivering online because you just miss out the cues. And anyway, we spoke about that last week in our Zoom fatigue conversation. But some people probably are in their absolute pigs and shit. Some people will be absolutely loving working from home all day. I don't have to get dressed and I'm loving life. And I didn't like my friends anyway at work. They all piss me off. My colleagues are annoying and I'm now getting so much work done and eating really healthily, saving loads of money. You know, people out there are living life. I reckon it's about 5% of the population. But as we know from the statistic, 20% may be a push.
Yeah. You know? No, it's true. And it's the thing, right, that we're all just having such quite distinct experiences. And I guess in a way, they are extra separate because of this situation. Like, of course, there's less unification because we're not all going to work. We're not all doing the same thing. And so, your experiences can feel deeply divided. Sometimes in big ways, sometimes in silly ways. Like, you know, you're there showing me the stuff that your kids have left and I'm looking around and being like, this room is messy and it has been messy since March.
Yeah.
I have partly cleaned it several times, but, you know, it is a reflection of my mind at this time that things are a bit more turbulent, but that is its own distraction.
Yeah.
You know, we should have a perfectly tidy workplace, but equally, we don't expect colleagues to keep most of their workplaces clean normally. I remember the first time I worked in an office that had a clean desk policy, and I found it really difficult to get used to having to put everything away before you could leave. And that's small. I didn't have to wipe down anything.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I haven't worked in an office for years. But actually, that brings me on to a point. Some of the research that we found was around actually architecture. They're really starting to look at how all houses are going to be built where people can have a space to work.
Yeah, so it's coming. I think that way about balconies. Like, no one's ever been as smug about having a balcony till now. And so I think we'll see that as a real trend. More balconies.
More balconies.
I guess we'll find out. Time will tell. But for now, we should introduce our guest. And it's Emma Mainu, who specialises in going into workplaces to institute change. And so at the moment, just like us, her work has changed to more working from home, less going to other people's offices, and more consultations and such via Zoom. And in doing so, she's become so well informed of this particular version of working. You know, she's very much on the front line of helping people get used to it and understand what the boundaries are.
Absolutely. And especially for those that aren't familiar with it, like we said, you know, there's some that maybe have been introduced to agile working and home working for quite a while and a few years. It's not like a new thing, but there were some who still never, ever have. But it's just really important, I guess, to just keep doing those basic things that we hear about doing that are really important, like taking your fresh air and eating and contacting colleagues, and you know, and by phone. You know, we shouldn't forget the phone. We seem to have forgotten to pick up the phone and ring someone, and that's important too, because they don't have to see your bedroom or your face or your hair.
Yeah,
you can literally be in bed and phone someone.
No, for sure. And so we're really glad that there are services like that out there. You know, there's work that Emma's involved in where businesses are getting outside experts in to help with this stuff and provide, mm-hmm. you know, guidance on how employees can take these steps, which a lot of the time aren't massive. You know, they're same things we've been banging on about in terms of routine, in terms of structure, in terms of boundaries, but can make a big difference. And a lot of workplaces aren't yet equipped to maybe give that advice themselves. So yeah, good episode. Please enjoy this conversation with Emma Mainu. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, my name's Emma Mainu. And at the moment, I'm just thinking about the first time that now I recognize I had a mental health problem. But at the time, it was just a sense of worry, of loneliness, of being different to other people. And I didn't have the emotional language at that time to express what I was going through. You know, people around me, family members, would always call me Anxious Annie, which is kind of ironic because anxiety has been a thing for me. But at the age of 14, I was at an all-girls private school in Alderley Edge, Cheshire, which is where I'm originally from. It was a very kind of privileged school with privileged girls, of which I was not one. So I'd won a bursary to go to this school. And my home life was something that was quite disrupted at the time. And I was just always worried, always feeling like a sense that something would go wrong, that I wasn't good enough. And going to this school was a place that really reinforced that. Pretty much from the day that I started, I was bullied really badly. It kind of started with feelings of dread about going to school, accelerating through to how can I avoid going to school, thinking about ways that I could maybe not be around anymore, that the experience was so daunting and frightening to me. And I really struggled to connect with others because of this overwhelming sense of fear about the worst things that could happen. I used to have really awful thoughts about bad things happening to me. I remember being a child and being quite sensitive and saying that I was frightened. I think I was 4 years old. I told my mum I was depressed. I think I'd heard it on TV.
Wow.
But it's 14 years old. I just remember the culmination of hormones, and it's so important to fit in at that age. And I really didn't. And fear, just overwhelming fear. And I think when I talk about my mental health today, when I go out and talk about it, it's that moment I always look back at, because I spent 20 years running away from that girl. 14 when I started to control my food, to not eat, to start to kind of experiment with disordered eating, which would become something for me that became an eating disorder when I was 17. But it started to take root when I was about 14. By the time I was 17, I had anorexia. So that's my earliest memory, really.
Wow. And it's quite heartbreaking to hear that, partly because, unfortunately, it's so common that that's such a turbulent age anyway. And particularly if you'd had struggles like I did as well, preceding that, then that kind of age group is where there can be a lot of shifts. For me, it was a lot around like social shifts at school, like a lot of people falling out with each other. We're all a bit more hormonal. And so it became easy for me to turn that from being a really social, popular kid into sitting in the library, because I was worried I didn't have friends anymore. And also conveniently, then I was away from food. And so I think part of that age and the turbulence can facilitate not just the issues, but also the lack of awareness that we're just trying to figure everything out. And so we can go down maladaptive paths that feel at the time somehow productive or like we are coping.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when I look at how people are parenting today and how children education has been raised around emotions for children, there's an encouragement to express how you're feeling. But at that age, at that time, you know, I'm going back probably to about, how old was I then, 1992? You know, it was just get on with it. What are you moaning for? And, you know, when we spoke with the headmistress, it was a convent school I was at. You know, the advice was to go and sit in the library to avoid the bullies or to pray for them because they were having a difficult time in their own personal lives, you know. And I wasn't, in their opinion, you know, white enough, rich enough, cool enough. I didn't have ponies. I didn't live in a certain area. And I was made to know that every single day, you know. And going home wasn't always the best experience. My parents had a really messy divorce. My mum was really struggling. And there was just felt like there was no safe place for me. There was nobody that would sit with me and ask me why I was kind of had the behaviors that I had around food. I was just shamed for it and told just to eat or stop attention seeking. Nobody at school would support me. There were no counselors. It was just a case of get on with it, toughen up. And that's the environment that I was in at that age. I didn't have siblings to lean on. I felt very, very alone in my world at that age.
No, of course. Yeah, I can understand and relate to a lot of that. And I think those kind of environments, because they can be seen from the outside as aspirational, we can therefore assume everything is rosy and perfect inside. But of course, any group of people, anywhere where people congregate of any age, issues arise.
And I just think, like, in the work that I do now that's all about inclusion, we ask people at the start of an inclusion journey to think of a moment when they most belonged. And we ask them also to think about moments where they felt like they were in the outside group. Why that's important is that if we can think about those moments, we can foster empathy for others. And it certainly is those moments of feeling like I didn't belong, of being made to feel like I didn't belong, that are the moments that mean now that if I'm in a room, if I'm at a party and I see somebody stood there, you know, nervously with glass in hand, I will go over to that person. It's no surprise to me now that I'm working in inclusion. It was no plan, but it's what drives me. When I tell a story and I see somebody nod their head or I have a conversation with somebody afterwards and they say to me, this is the first time I've told anybody. I know the isolation that person has felt, because at 14, I felt it. I felt it for 20 years. As I high kicked my way through bars in Soho or showed up at a pitch meeting dressed to the nines, I often felt like I didn't belong there. And I want people to feel like they're less alone. It's a feeling that never leaves you. You never, ever forget that feeling.
Definitely. It's something about particular emotions that you can just connect to so easily. And that's definitely something I've had to get support with around my experience of depression. So often, as a child, not knowing better, thinking that was loneliness. And, you know, still today, as much as I go to counselling and have done a lot of work on my recovery, sometimes that does happen. Sometimes you look around, you know, a coffee shop where we could still go to those, and you realize you're one of the last people there. And the smallest things can give you that tinge of loneliness.
Loneliness has been a massive thread in my life. You know, in 2012, I had a breakdown, which is something that I speak about, you know, quite often. But I felt incredibly lonely at that time because I've been hiding. You know, we feel lonely. People think loneliness is not having friends. Like, I was the girl with the mates and the holidays in Ibiza and the, you know, the team and like dancing on the table from the North England. That's what we do. That's what we've always done. And, you know, looked to everyone like I was having the best time. But loneliness is the thing that happens when we're not allowing ourselves to be seen. When I was hiding things that I felt ashamed of, when I was hiding parts of myself, I felt lonely in my romantic relationships, in my friendships. I felt lonely so often. Following my breakdown, when I went back into work, the workplace, it was a great place for me to hide again. I didn't want anyone to know what happened to me. And so when I launched my blog, Surviving Sundays, 3 years ago, which is all about recovery, the hashtag I've put on every post, I mean, there must be like over 1,000 posts by now, for the last 3 years has been hashtag you are not alone. Because you feel, it's not about not having friends. Like, you can have a breakdown. There are people that might want to hold your hand through that experience. You have to do the work on your own, okay? But if you can't be the most authentic version of yourself, if you can't be honest and open with somebody, you're going to feel alone. So loneliness is something that I really, really relate to. And I know I can't fix it for others. And some days I can't fix it for myself. I've learned to sit with it now.
Right. But even that is so much power, the talking about it and the demystifying, because it's like a lot of concepts that are maybe more abstract than we feel comfortable with. It's the same with happiness. We like to think in our head we have a clear idea of what that is, and yet it's such a lifetime of trying to find it, right? And it's kind of the same with loneliness, that it's something that we understand in an emotional level, we can connect to, but when you try and describe it, and that's why you get these situations like feeling lonely in a crowd, which feels like it shouldn't be the case, and yet that can be one of the most lonely experiences, feeling that you're out of place or you're disconnected even in a crowded space. It's, you know, it's this parallel stigma. If we're not talking about loneliness, of course we find situations like that and are surprised they're lonely.
Absolutely. You know, and I truly relate to that. I mean, 30th of December will be 2 years since I gave up drinking. And, you know, I'm not somebody that's in recovery. I'm not somebody that's in a 12-step program. I really have a lot of respect and gratitude for those programs who have helped the community that I work with, who have helped friends and family members of mine. But my story was that of a binge drinker, okay, a grey area drinker that could not drink as I kind of did my workouts for a month, or I'm going on holiday and I'm going to look really great, so I'm not going to drink, you know. But then Friday night, 2 drinks, great, 3, you know, all bets are off. And when I did the work to look at kind of why this cycle was happening, it was about connection. It was about loneliness. It was about wanting to escape my feelings, but also feeling like this false connect. I could talk all night to people, like I wasn't alone, and I would overshare. You know, the things that I was hiding, that I felt afraid of, I was sharing. It was all about trying to find connection. So I really, really do relate to that. I really do.
I don't drink myself, but I think that's something that in a way is part of the reason why. So, of course, the first thing you get asked, I'm sure you're the same, when you say you don't drink, is everyone's like, oh, why? Or some people are scared to ask why if they've got mental health stigma and they think that might be the answer. It's almost always one of those two. Is that making sense?
Well, you're lucky if you get asked why. You're usually told to just get over it and have a drink, in my experience.
Interesting.
I love the people right. That force it. Oh, come on. Don't be boring. You know, you're lucky if you get asked why. I mean, are you pregnant? Are you sick? Are you an alcoholic? I mean, in what other world would you say that to anybody about anything? You know, you don't want to have a cigarette. Are you pregnant? I mean, nobody's saying that to you, are they? They're just saying it's okay. And, you know, what I will say is I thought not drinking would mean less fun, less connection. It's more of everything for me, you know, more connection, more honesty, more time, more self-respect, more dignity.
No, I've definitely got a lot of those questions and that level of directness. I've had less of the people trying to peer pressure me, but maybe I give off a vibe that that's not going to work, a certain stubbornness anyway. But it's something that people really want an answer to. And then I've found that often you start giving an answer, and particularly for us, it sounds like, you know, it's a layered thing. There is no easy, oh, it's this one single reason. And perhaps they don't want to hear it. Maybe they don't want to question that, but also it can feel sort of strangely like counterculture, you know, particularly coming up to Christmas, to not be having a drink with the family somehow makes people quite uncomfortable. And I think, yeah, you're just full of all the conversations that people don't have seem to be your areas so far.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's with the drinking thing, what I notice is because I'm in that grey area, and if nobody's read about grey area drinking, like it's a great thing to kind of study. I was like, bingo, when I read about grey area drinking, because it just defined my experience, is a lot of people saying, but you weren't that bad, but you've not got a problem, but why? But, you know, trying to kind of
explain
tell me that
way.
I'm okay to drink. And I'm like, do you know what? After we had 2 drinks together, I went home with a lot of anxiety. Like, you weren't in my head. You weren't sat there with me. You weren't the one that woke up thinking about the things that they'd said. So really, you can't tell me how bad or good it is, you know, and your definitions of what a problem are not my experience of it. Somebody doesn't have to be like losing their job or burning their house down to have a problem. Like, if you can't show up for yourself and be the best that you want to be, and if you're not being honest about who you are, because when you drink, you just like a clown, that was me, you know, it's not good for you. That's a problem. That is what I would call a problem.
I think it can just be that simple. Yeah. And I've had that conversation with somebody where I've had to go as far as to say, look, I'm not anti-drinking. I'm just anti-drinking for me.
For me.
You know, yeah, I totally grew up around a lot of friends of mine binge drinking, and I think fell into the like caring sober role before I even chose to. And then it got, you know, when I got older and I started considering, should I be drinking? I just had enough reasons not to. And I was already comfortable. And certain things like being comfortable dancing in public without being at least tipsy. I thought, you know, I'm not sure if I'll keep that if I start drinking.
I mean, the big can I dance thing, I was so anxious about that. I was really anxious about that. And then I went to Ibiza and went out till 5 o'clock in the morning drinking Red Bull. I think I was like Beyonce when I drank, throwing myself everywhere. I got my hair once stuck in a fan in a club in Dubai, lashing it around like Beyonce, nearly lost half my hair as it got dragged into the fan. I think that happened to her too, actually. But things we do when we drink. But yeah, no, you know, I went out and had a great time. Brilliant. Like the bass was so good. Like the tunes were so good. Had a brilliant time. But you got to, you know, all these fears we have about how awful things might be if we stop drinking. But it's been brilliant for me.
And the simple truth of it is people don't care nearly as much as you think they do. They're busy worrying about their own dancing, or they're too drunk to know. You know, that's the one benefit of being around people when you're not the drunk one. You will remember the next day, and a lot of them won't.
Yeah. And you leave hours before it gets bad, you know. And I think now, like, it's been so long, my friends now just really get it. And they're really supportive. You just tend to, you know, it's been a while actually since I've been out socially and anybody's had an opportunity to force a drink on me because of the situation that we're now in. But it tends to be new people that get quite curious about it.
Yeah, definitely. And circling towards our theme, you'd mentioned about the workplace being somewhere you found that you could really hide your anxiety. And so could you share a little bit more about how that developed?
I mean, the workplace was just a brilliant place for me in some ways, actually, but also it was like a thief in the night. I didn't realize it was like stealing from me at the same time. So workplace, being somebody that had kind of had low self-esteem for a long time, I was massively codependent. Like my whole existence was around fear of people rejecting me or not liking me. So every decision that I made was kind of based on that. And the workplace was the first place that I got praise, that I could see the results of my efforts. Either a project would be well done, or a client would be happy, or my boss would say good job, or you'd win an award, or I'd get a promotion. And it started to give me a great sense of self and of purpose. Work on that kind of side of it was really, really big, really, really good for me. But the other thing was that I was quite high functioning. And when you're working in kind of media and marketing, which I was for years, it's a lot of late hours, a lot of deadlines, and you need adrenaline in order to meet those things. I was living on my adrenaline, but also at the same time, anxiety about whether I was good enough sometimes. Perfect wasn't enough. Like it would always be over-delivering, over-preparing, overwriting, over-stressing. And when you're in a high-performance environment, people just see that as performance a lot of the time, I've noticed. And this, like, I read something the other day on Instagram, people saying people need to stop wearing their burnout as a badge of honor. And I found that was a lot of the language that I was around, was people being exhausted. I'm so tired, I'm exhausted. I finished at midnight. Like that was just like a lot of the way, you know, and socializing went hand in hand with work in it in my day. So you kind of like go out all night and then get up and get back at it. So you look around you and everybody's doing the same thing. So how does anybody spot you, what you're going through? Especially if you're somebody that's like a people pleaser who just wants everyone to think that everything's okay all of the time. So it was a great place to hide. It was a great place to feel good, but it was also a great place to be distracted. You know, when some awful things were happening, it was a place that I could go and just get my head into a project and ignore the things. But when you're doing that, you know, your adrenaline's spiking all the time, you're ignoring your problems, you're drinking a bit too much, you're not sleeping well, there's a payoff, which there was for me in the end. And I, you know, I've had burnout. You don't realize what you're kind of giving away when you're doing that until it's too late. So yeah, you know, that's my experience of having mental health challenges in the workplace to that point that I had a breakdown in 2012 and kind of beyond that really for probably another 5 years before I just was like, I've got to address my work life and its impact upon me, which is something that I then did. I kind of left agency life and went freelance and reduced my working hours and just made decisions around, you know, I was moaning about these clients all the time. Like 70% of my day was moaning about clients and work. And like, what could I do about it? That was the question I asked myself. Are you just going to keep moaning and whinging and hating life and getting up every day? Or do something about it and change the course of what you're doing, which is when I started to really think, right, okay, I've had all these experiences with my mental health. I do need to get paid. So I'm going to do the marketing work that I've always known how to do. But a day a week or 2 days a week is actually going to be about the thing that I love. That's kind of how I changed and created a bit more balance and enjoyment in my life. And now I'm 100% mental health work at Utopia.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And it's massive to do that as well, to strike out on your own and decide this is wrong. When these behaviours are so normalised, you are having to have that level of awareness to be like, we are all doing this wrong. That's quite a big thing to wrap your head around when you've spent any period of time in corporate workplaces. And I guess my nearest version of that was when I used to work in banking for a few years. I worked in fraud prevention, so it was kind of technical and office-based, and there wasn't a huge amount of talking between colleagues. Like, you were strongly discouraged, obviously we still did, but it doesn't breed an environment where you're open about your feelings. They're all for everyone checking in with each other, but it's how are you, fine, how are you, fine. And very quickly, people that get to know me realize that I'm not the kind of person that's going to settle for that. I even sometimes, just to highlight it to people that always say they're fine, I will act really surprised sometimes just to shake them out of the automation. I'm like, oh dear, why only fine? And then you see them wake up and actually answer you genuinely the second time, because it can be so normalized. And I remember just feeling like, some days I'd look around at my colleagues and we're all stressed and the business was going through a lot of changes. And I thought, I bet we're all going home and ranting at home about this place. And management hardly hear about it. And we hardly hear about it from each other. And yet that is, I would say, the majority of workplaces of any kind of scale.
Yeah. And I think at this moment as well, we all know that barriers between work and home life are blurred like never before. We know that numbers around depression and anxiety are soaring, and the likelihood is, statistics show, that people are more likely to burn out while working from home than they are in an office environment, especially with everything that we have happening in the world. And I think there are a few things actually that contribute to it. One, if we look at ourselves, a couple of things. One is our emotional language. So we tend to say things like sad, when there may be another whole kind of range of words under that. We're not used to, you know, at an early age, describing our feelings, you know, isn't something that we're naturally encouraged to do. So we become quite limited with the words that we use. And like, if you find a feelings wheel, that's something you can kind of Google and look for, you'll see that that can start with like a circle in the middle, sad, mad, joy, happiness. But actually, there are so many other words we can use. So firstly, is the language we use. Secondly,
actually, I just want to pause on that, because that's so important. And I think about that a lot, because the example of sad, that could mean bored for some people, or that could mean I'm in despair for other people, or I'm feeling hopeless. And particularly at a time when we are communicating a lot over Zoom like this, and we're limited on the other cues we can get, I think it's possibly more important than ever to know, what do they really mean?
Yeah, and knowing our language and studying our language and the language that we use is really important, but also having access to those feelings. So we also can tend to have quite a limited emotional range. We think that sad is bad, we're doing something wrong if we feel sad, and happiness is good, and that's the only feeling. And so when things like loneliness happen, we just want to shut them down. When we're frightened or we're angry, or we feel ashamed that we were frightened about something, or angry, you know, oh God, that's a really awful feeling, I'm not an angry person. So we just shut them down rather than sitting with them. So the more connected we can get, one, to what we're actually feeling, you know, putting that drink away, shutting your laptop down for like half an hour, meditating or journaling and sitting with, what am I actually feeling today? Okay. Then thinking about the language that we can use to communicate that to somebody. But when we communicate that to somebody, are we in a workplace where there's psychological safety? It's okay telling everybody we have counselors and speak up about your mental health. But the leaders of the business are not people that are creating environments that feel inclusive, that feel supportive. And if mental health feels like a tick box exercise, people then might have all the language and all the feelings, but think there'll be a consequence if they say how they are feeling. So there are a number of things that need to be considered to create environments where people can not only speak up, but get the support that they really need at a time like this.
For sure. And I'd interrupted you. You had another point you were going to move on to?
No, it was those things, really. Oh. You know,
you
the language.
One.
There's three things.
No, that's brilliant. You did a great job of linking those in. It's a brilliant trio. And the example you gave of loneliness, a really great example of that, because what happens when you push down loneliness and you don't talk about it, you feel more lonely and isolated. And so many of the default approaches to overcoming feelings we're not comfortable with just create more of those feelings. And that's just as true at home as in a workplace. But of course, at the moment, like you say, those lines are blurred. And I think with burnout, as you say, being so common, my personal theory on that is that a lot of it comes down to people feeling inferior at home, that we know we're maybe not as productive. We know there's certain things we can't do, like go over to a colleague at another desk and ask them a question. You know, you either have to reach out to them and maybe you don't bother because you're like, oh, it's a quick question. It's not worth me calling them. And so I think there's all these little ways that people can feel inferior in their ability to work from home. Maybe they've got bad internet connection. It could be any number of things. And then our natural response to that is, I need to push myself further. The internet is bad, but I need to be the one that makes up for it by working even harder, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole other layer of stuff as well. I mean, we're now not just having meetings, we're having windows into people's lives through Zoom. You know, we see the people that live in a house share who are at war with their flatmates. We're getting a sense of the people that are struggling with their kids and the commitments. And those things wrapped around presenteeism, it's not a happy combo. People thinking, okay, well, I need to do a call now, but I can't do it in a quiet space because my flatmate's going to have the blender on. And if I say anything, they're going to say that I'm taking over the kitchen. Or your partner's at home, they've been furloughed or they're out of work and you've had a disagreement about something last night and that's hanging around you in the space that you're working in while you're trying to deliver, can be pushing people into a place not only of like wanting to overperform, but actually to a place of inertia. Some people are struggling to get it going. Like, honestly, I talk about being high performing, you know, and somebody who has used anxiety to fuel them, which is not anything I ever recommend doing. But these days have been really tiring for me, you know, and I've got support and I've got tools and I've got a supportive team. But there have been days, particularly on the weekends, where I wake up and I'm just like, I can't. I ain't got it today. Because the usual outlets of a spin class or a dinner with a friend or the solo cinema dates that I used to go to on a Sunday afternoon just aren't there. So all it is chats about work online or I'm doing the work. And if I'm lucky, I'll see a friend if I've got the emotional energy. So people are really, really going through a lot. I think these days, you know, working from home used to be a privilege. It was something, oh, we do to work from home. Now feels like a home invasion for a lot of people. Have you even furnished your staff with a correct laptop holder or a chair for them to sit in? Or are you just accepting that they're sitting on their kitchen furniture, not thinking about their posture or their health? You've invaded their home, you know?
Right. And that's massive because that could be seen as something small. But I know enough of the behind the scenes of workplaces to know how much effort goes into choosing the right chair and the right like measurement, exact centimeter of how high the table is. And this stuff all counts in the workplace, but perhaps, like you say, even more in your own home, because what happens, you finish your Zoom call and then maybe it's the same laptop and you go onto Netflix and you've got another few hours in front of the same screen with the same bad posture.
Or you're like, you know, you finished your meeting in the office, you have a little walk round to the vending machine, maybe you'll go downstairs and get a cup of tea from the cafeteria. Are your colleagues just booking you in one session after another in your diary, not even giving you 5 minutes to go to the toilet? You know, there are small things that people can consider. Don't just see a space and like book it in and assume somebody's free. You know, ask them how much time they need, because people are just getting overworked without enough of an understanding of what the nuances might be for somebody who might be not only a parent, perhaps they're a carer. You know, perhaps they have an elderly relative or they have somebody that's unwell at home that they need to take care of. And the best organizations that I'm working with at the moment, honestly, I'm seeing some great businesses that are just doing some great things. There's one company that I work with who have gone from a team of 10 to 60 during lockdown. So that's 60 people who've never met each other in the real world. You know, and colleagues that probably shown up for their first day via Zoom, worried about connecting or being honest about where they're at. And when can they do that? When can they talk about things, you know?
It can be scary enough just worrying about what you wear on your first day, let alone what does the background of my home look like?
Yeah. you know, but what if you had a rough night's sleep last night because somebody in your house is coughing and you're worried that they've got corona, or, you know, somebody that you really care about is depressed at the moment. There's just so many layers for people. And then they've got to come to their first day and think about getting to know their colleagues and how honest they can be. Well, you can't do that by a coffee machine anymore, you know, or walk to Pret or wherever to get your lunch together and just have a bit of a chat about last night's TV. Those things are really missing. A study showed recently that 60% of young people who are working from home at the moment are really feeling disconnection, but also concerned about career progression. Those moments you might get in the pub or at an event with your boss or your peers. A lot of people aren't having those. There's a lot of anxiety around that. So the best businesses, really, I find, are the ones that are creating space to talk about the non-work stuff. So at Utopia, we created something called Utopia Movie Night. Our co-founder, Daniele, is a real like film fan. Through the first lockdown, it's still going on. I've left the WhatsApp group because there was just so many films. I think it was about 200 films by now. But I loved the idea in the first lockdown. But, you know, there was a film every night that people could watch and then discuss. It just gave people something else to talk about, to connect through film. We then created something called Belonging Hour, something where we ask people to come to this event where they play 1 minute of a song that represents belonging to them. And we've seen other companies taking that on now because people are just dancing. Their teammates are dancing or they're sharing a story of belonging around 1 minute of their song. And we're seeing companies really kind of bring people together through things like that outside of work, which is really, really important.
That's so brilliant. And one thing I know you talk about as well with this is about that idea of how honest you can be. That people are feeling more self-conscious at the moment, partly because of the context, partly from working from home and the challenges. And so do you think there are not just more people struggling with their mental health at work at the moment, but also more people feeling the need to hide it and pretend they're okay?
I mean, I've seen numbers that have shown, you know, a 211% rise in significant anxiety, but I don't know how many other people are not going to a doctor and talking about it. But not even not going to a doctor. I see people who are clearly stressed and anxious, just thinking that that's something that should be normal right now and is okay and acceptable, and not having the emotional language. We talked about that at the beginning of this. You know, 14 years old, I didn't even probably know what anxiety was. There are many people today who think anxiety is only having panic attacks and depression is only being burnt out and wanting to not be here anymore. But they're not appreciating that there's a spectrum of experience. I think sometimes people actually maybe aren't tuning in to what's going on to be able to share it. And the other thing is, there's a big emphasis on people speaking up about their mental health. We have to also appreciate sometimes your boss isn't the person to hear you. You know, they may not have the skills that, you know, mental health first aid is a great thing that will enable people to be heard in an organization. But a lot of people don't have basic listening skills. And it's a big pressure for them also to be a person to support somebody with a mental health problem. And also forcing people to talk about their mental health isn't something that we should be doing either. People might have had traumatic experiences or experiences where they need to speak to somebody. I mean, I can talk to you about earlier this year, obviously, that everything that's happened, the heightened awareness around the conversations around race, the murder of George Floyd, a lot of people have needed culturally appropriate support. It's been really nice for employees to check in with each other and for bosses to ask people to lean in and to speak up and to speak out. But for many people, it hasn't felt safe to do so, you know, because of historic discrimination and exclusion, it's not felt safe to do so. And so when we ask people, oh, they seem fine, we've asked them how they are, then they must be fine because they're not speaking up. We have to sometimes take these things into consideration.
Oh, for sure. And I think what you said there is so important about the culturally relevant support, you know, understanding how different people are coping during this time. And that applies to really everything. You know, that could be certain people, depending, like you've said, on their home situation, may find it more or less difficult. Maybe someone that's a parent needs more flexible hours than someone that's not. But absolutely, the conversations around racism are so key. And something that I've seen with my own friends in their workplaces is this being handled badly, but with good intentions. And the kind of irony of, I've seen a few of my friends have the spotlight really put on them as, oh, well, you know, we're trying to do more around racism. And essentially, although it's not said, it's implied, oh, you're black, do a talk for us. Get on a Zoom in front of 200 colleagues at the company, most of whom you've never met, and talk about your lived experience of this at a time when you're struggling more than usual because of lockdown and because of what's happened with George Floyd and so many others.
Yeah, and I think what people aren't appreciating, I mean, by the way, I love to say, I'm not your black Google. I'm not your black search engine. Yeah. Like, you know, go look, go search. But, you know, there's something called racial battle fatigue. And people are talking about, oh, you know, since the Black Lives Matter movement, since George Floyd, it's painful because it's a reminder of an experience that people have had for most of their lives. You know, the battle has been long for many people. But to be honest with you, the conversations for me that weren't had at all, they were the most painful thing to experience. People that I know and love and have worked with who would have conversations with me throughout those weeks about everything other than asking how I felt, knowing the space in which I work as well. You know, so I think a lot of people have learned, and it's been a really, really difficult time. But, you know, being asked how you feel is something that we do when there's been trauma, right? And it just didn't seem to be there around this topic because of fear. You know, fear of getting it wrong. It wasn't that people always had bad intent. It was fear of getting it wrong or being called a racist or putting their foot in it. But just asking somebody how they're feeling can never be a bad thing, in my opinion.
Oh, for sure.
Acknowledging somebody.
Yeah. And I think a tip I would have for that for other white people is that you can lead with your own experience. You know, even if it is you don't really know what to say or you're a bit confused by some of what's been happening in America, you don't understand the system or the differences and discrimination over there, that is okay to say. It is okay for you to say, I'm trying to understand it, and lead with that rather than putting the expectation on the person of color to lead with their experience. This is affecting all of us, and it should be affecting all of us.
Mm.
You know, one of the best conversations I had with a friend who's white is him saying to me that with George Floyd's murder, he didn't want to watch the video. You know, he knew what the video was, and he didn't feel like watching it, and then had to realize, oh, well, this is a privilege. I have the choice to engage in what's happening with racism. Because of his context and his background and growing up in a very white area and a family that reflects that as well, he's not going to hear as many of these conversations unless he seeks them out, unless he clicks play. Whereas for people of color, that is already part of your lived experience, that of many of the people around you. And there's even more expectation that you are clued in to what's happening and watch the videos and read the articles.
Yeah, and I'm not going to do that, you know. And all I could think about was my father or my uncle under somebody's knee. Do I want to watch that over and over and different variations of that? And here's another black man or woman or person who's been abused, like, you know, tagging you in that stuff and sharing that stuff with you. Like, you need to see this. Like, I don't need to see that, you know. And the nature of the things that I'm watching at the moment, I've noticed has changed. I went to the cinema, I've watched films about civil rights, I've read books about civil rights, I've watched documentaries. But honestly, working in this space, having conversations in this space, I just want to watch A Star Is Born right now, you know, the Judy Garland version, not the Bradley Cooper Gaga version, which just makes me like feel hysterical. Or I want to watch The Wizard of Oz, or I want to, you know, just not be engaging with something 24/7. That forms a part of my real world experience. It's very frightening and divisive.
For sure. And that comes back to the workplace as well, that it can be so easy to feel overwhelmed really by anything we spend too much time in, and that includes work. So we need to have these boundaries in terms of when you finish work, maybe even which rooms your work laptop goes in. You know, all these things can make a big difference, and it's about having these boundaries, because we're in a time when the boundaries aren't there from a working perspective, but the boundaries are also less there because of how internet involved we are right now. But there are similar interventions you can make.
I relate to that, and I think I have a responsibility. You know, for me, it's different because this is my work. You know, I work in mental health, but I also work in a culture change business, and I work in inclusion. So I have to be educated. I have to be informed. I have to lean into discussions. I have to bring in my lived experience. And for me, it takes up so much, not only of the hours in which I'm delivering via Zoom, but also the research I do around it. Mm. I give myself a pass to opt out, you know, to just take the time that I need to take for me. But that's all about boundary setting, you know. And you might not work in my world, and something might feel very distressing to you, and you can opt out of that conversation if it's triggering for your mental health. But, you know, there's a point in time also where people should be looking to educate themselves if they want to be inclusive.
Yeah. I guess the only other thing you've reminded me of is also the types of medium can make a big difference. Mm. You know, for me, I prefer to consume news when I'm feeling emotionally vulnerable via watching the news or going to a particular news outlet that I trust, like a paper or digitally, as opposed to getting it via social media, where you've got the additional layer of what everyone's saying about it. And people, maybe making the stories even more extreme with their headlines and their commentary. Yeah.
They're reductive, then we get all the comments from all the other people that are going to comment. And I completely agree with you on that about frequency, the source, but also the frequency. I was in a place, dark place, earlier this year where I was seeking out news and watching constant news cycles. Like CNN was on the whole time. And then I was seeking news and just wanting to know what was happening with the protests and then the election. And then it just to be able to check in with yourself and say, okay, I can feel what's happening in my body here. I can feel this is affecting me, and stopping that and muting what you need to mute and just finding like one good news source has been something that's really helped me.
For sure, definitely. And yeah, I can relate to that. I started having dreams about the election. That's how much of it I was watching. So yeah, boundaries for work, but potentially boundaries for everything. And we will wrap up there then. Thank you so much for joining us. If people want to find out more about your work, where should they go online?
So you can find me at We Are Utopians. That's where you can find me, at Utopia. And my blog is at Surviving_Sundays, both on Instagram.
And there's also a podcast version for that as well, right?
Yeah, you can find that. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very really welcome. Good. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.